The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia, New Jersey. Another edition of Inside Medicine is about to unfold. I have a fantastic guest today, Dr. Philip Nemoyton, an MD, FACC, clinical cardiologist from Philadelphia. But I just want to open up with a few cardiovascular statistics. 9.7 million adults have undiagnosed diabetes. Yes, I'm going to be in business. 29.3 million adults have diagnosed diabetes. I'm getting tired already. 115.9 million adults have pre-diabetes when you're coming around the corner. So I've got a lot of work to do, but diabetes tends to generate a cardiovascular risk. And we have 224,000 age-adjusted U.S. deaths attributable to cardiovascular death since 2021, and age-adjusted global death rate attributable to cardiovascular disease, 237,900. So Phil Nemoyton is my guest. Phil is a seasoned cardiologist. He's a clinical cardiologist at Cardiology Consultants of Philadelphia at Jefferson. He has a Bachelor of Science degree in biology with distinction from the University of the Sciences and a Doctor of Medicine degree from Sidney Kimmel Medical College at Thomas Jefferson University. His internship was at Drexel University College of Medicine, i.e. Hahnemann, and his residency, internal medicine, and fellowship in cardiovascular disease were at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. He is a diplomat of the American Board of Internal Medicine and Subspecialty Board of Cardiovascular Disease, and is a fellow of the American College of Cardiology. Dr. Nemoyton is a clinical assistant professor of medicine at Sidney Kimmel Medical College at Jefferson and an attending physician at Thomas Jefferson Hospital, where he has held numerous leadership positions, including president of the medical staff. I bet he was happy to get over that. Chair of several committees of the medical staff, member of the hospital board of trustees, tip top, and was a member of the executive committee of the medical staff for 18 years. He is established. He has published in the fields of genetic disease, perioperative cardiovascular medicine, lipid disorders, and preventive cardiology. Phil, thank you very much for hopping on Inside Medicine. Can you just maybe start off with what are the different types of cardiovascular disease?
Good morning, Joe, and thanks for having me as a guest on your program to discuss this exciting field of cardiovascular inflammation. I'm glad you asked because there are many different types of heart disease. Heart disease can affect any part of the heart, including the heart muscle, the valves that control the flow of blood through the heart chambers, the coronary arteries that supply the heart muscle with blood, the electrical system of the heart, which consists of nerves, and cardiovascular disease can also include disorders affecting the blood vessels elsewhere in the body.
So basically with that said in place, can you just define what is coronary artery disease?
Sure. Coronary artery disease is a process where material gets deposited in the inner lining of one or more of the three arteries supplying the heart muscle with blood. And this material includes fatty deposits called lipids. It includes white blood cells, which are inflammatory in nature after they ingest some of the lipid material, and calcium. And this plaque then can decrease the flow of blood through the arteries. And if the plaque activates and disrupts either by a rupture of the cap of the plaque or ulceration, those materials can get exposed to the blood in the artery and can produce a heart attack or other problems.
So what you're saying is this coronary vessel basically is very smooth, usually glistening, has no fatty buildup, no issues such as that. But when cardiac disease starts to evolve by layers of inflammation in the initial part of the wall of the vessels, that's where you get involved.
Right. I think you hit the nail on the head there that usually the artery is smooth and glistening inside, because many people assume that a certain amount of coronary artery disease is, quote, normal as you get older, and that's not the case. It's a disease.
So Bill, how do you get involved? So, like, there's how many people with coronary artery disease, and how do you get called in to help out with patient care?
Okay, as you had indicated in your introduction, it is the coronary artery disease is the number one cause of death in the United States, resulting in over 800,000 heart attacks per year, and 20% of these people go on to have a recurrent heart attack if they're not properly managed and intervened on. Stroke is also the number five cause of death in the United States, resulting in 795,000 strokes, and there is a 25% recurrence rate. So altogether, arteriosclerotic cardiovascular disease results in in 2 million hospitalizations per year and 400,000 deaths per year. So that's over 1,000 per day, which is quite a devastating toll.
So, Phil, how does somebody, be recommended to see guys like Philip Nemoyten or somebody at Jefferson or one of the local cardiac centers? How do you end up with the patients?
Well, it can be from a variety of ways. One is obvious if the patient develops any kind of symptoms and decides to go to a cardiologist, but very often, it's either the person has a relative or a friend who has had an unexpected cardiac event, or hears of somebody who, without a previous history, has a heart attack or sudden death, and they decide to get evaluated.
I gotcha. So what are the causes of coronary artery disease? In other words, what happens to patients that they need to see a cardiologist such as yourself? And what is the setup? Is there something that the patients could do so they can delay cardiovascular disease?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the causes of coronary artery disease are many, and they include genetics, high blood pressure, known as hypertension, diabetes, which you appropriately referred to in the introduction, as that's a huge public health problem now, smoking, poor diet, elevated blood levels of cholesterol, and a sedentary lifestyle.
So, Phil, when a patient gets to you, usually that means they've been diagnosed with a problem. I would doubt that most people would, just knock on Phil Nemoyten's door, because basically you're busy taking care of those who already have disease. But what would make a patient decide they want to see a cardiologist? Because we want to make sure that everybody lives as long as they can, as well as they can.
Right. So usually it could either be symptoms such as chest pain, shortness of breath, decreased ability to do physical exercise, or actually in many cases now, either referred by a physician like yourself who, because of the fact that you're seeing a patient with other multiple risk factors, feels it's appropriate, or as I'm seeing in more and more patients coming in just saying, I want a cardiovascular risk stratification because my friend or my buddy, just got diagnosed with coronary artery disease.
So one thing that is a pickup to me is that a lot of people kind of know their lipid levels, and what happens if somebody has an LDL over 130? What is a cardiologist? How do they have a discussion with that patient that's just a little bit or more than a little bit too high?
I think that's a great question. The initial evaluation when a patient comes in like that is obviously to first do a medical history, a family history, to see if the individual has a history of coronary artery disease, especially if it occurred at a young age, and then performing a physical examination and electrocardiogram. The next step, if they don't have their lipid levels recently checked, or if they haven't had a comprehensive screening of their lipid levels, it's often appropriate to get additional studies. So the additional studies would include a lipid panel, which would evaluate the different lipid fractions, a test called lipoprotein little a. It's lipoprotein parentheses and then a little a end of parentheses, also known as LP little a, which is getting to be more commonly known now as a major risk factor. This is a factor that occurs in a significant percentage of the population. It's genetic, and it has been associated with an increased risk of coronary artery disease at a young age, stroke, and also aortic stenosis. And one of the reasons that it's getting more attention is that there will be some drugs coming available probably late in 2025 or early 2026 that will actually be able to treat that. Another test that is added in is called the high sensitivity C-reactive protein, also known as the cardio-C-reactive protein, which is a marker for vascular inflammation. And another test called apolipoprotein B, which is a blood test that tells you all the different atherogenic particles that the patient has. And then beyond that, additional testing that can be added can include a coronary calcium scoring test, which is a very quick CAT scan with very limited radiation that looks for calcium in the coronary arteries. And if an individual has calcium in the coronary arteries, they can get a risk score of what their future risk is of a coronary event. And then beyond the initial testing, if there's concern, other tests that could include would be various types of stress testing, or a test called CT coronary angiography, which is a CAT scan where you inject X-ray dye in the individual's arm and take pictures of the coronary arteries. And then the most definitive test, which is invasive, is a cardiac catheterization, which can actually fully visualize the arteries.
So, Phil, can you just describe, so what is your, if a patient sees you and you've discerned that they have coronary artery disease, do you ever make a diagnosis of that by doing that CT calcium score, and do the patients have to pay for that?
Yes, that's the, I'm glad you pointed that out. The CT calcium scoring test is the one general test that has not been traditionally covered by insurance, although since the beginning of 2024, Medicare is covering it, although sometimes the hospitals or imaging facilities don't seem to be aware of that. But it's not an expensive test. It usually costs anywhere between $100 and $130. And it's a very, very quick test. It takes about 10 minutes, very limited radiation exposure. In fact, the exposure is about one-tenth that of a nuclear stress test. And it can really be very helpful in giving the patients an objective indicator of what their risk is, as well as getting the patient more on board with doing something definitive to treat the atherosclerosis. Very often patients will come in and they'll say that they have had an elevated lipid level, but based upon what they saw on the internet or what they heard from their friends, that taking statins are not a good idea, and they'd rather not do so. And then when you show them the calcium score is very elevated, they suddenly seem to change their mind and they're on board with taking the treatment.
Yeah. So how long, you're saying that it's very quick. It's about $125. And the question is that a lot of times people's eyes just get wide open when they see that calcium score. So when someone comes up with a calcium score that's positive, do you get much resistance to try and intervene with certain medications to help them out?
Much less resistance, especially when the score is high.
So what's the definition of a high calcium score for the people out there?
So when they read the study,
I'm sure
you get
going to write that down, Phil.
Right. You get a total score, and then you get what's called a percentile score, which tells you where the individual fits compared to a matched group of people, matched for age, gender, race, and ethnicity. who neither have a diagnosis of clinical coronary artery disease or treated diabetes. And so people start to then ask, well, how narrowed is my artery? And you have to explain to them that this test does not tell you if an artery is narrowed enough to be limiting flow. And although many of the reports have at the bottom a little key saying between this level and this level is mild disease and between this level and this level is moderate disease, it doesn't always correlate with how narrowed an artery is, because much of the plaque is actually within the wall of the artery and may not necessarily be limiting the flow, but it is a very, very strong proven predictor of future risk. And so from the standpoint of trying to intervene with preventive measures, it's very, very useful. But on the other hand, if the score is very high, then you you have to make a decision about whether further imaging of the arteries is necessary.
So I would say that most patients, when I make that recommendation, you know, have a little hesitancy because no one's considering that they could possibly have any coronary artery disease. Yet we saw how much diabetes is out there, how much pre-diabetes is out there, and how many people are not on a statin yet if you're an American. Does that mean, so my impression is that if you have that calcium score that's positive, that just about all those patients should be taking a statin drug. Can I just get your input? You can say you don't agree with me, but
absolutely,
tell me from
I agree.
Your cardiovascular perspective.
I agree, absolutely. The only one negative I would say about the calcium score is that it's usually not recommended in individuals under 30, because the people under 30 who are developing plaque may not yet have developed what's called calcified plaque. And so they may get a zero score and then think that they don't have any risk. And so it's not used in very young people.
So Phil, you see a patient, a new patient, they come in and say, I got my calcium score, and my family doctor said, you know, hightail it over to see Phil Nemoyton. So how do you address that patient? What's your attack to make sure that they live long and actually possibly can regress some of that plaque?
So I make sure that their lipid levels are recent. I make sure that they have the other factors checked, including the LP little a, the high sensitivity C-reactive protein, ApoB, and take that into the context of their family history and their current history, and then trying to explain to them how they have a significant ability to significantly alter their future risk. And it's up to them if they want to take that opportunity and try to mitigate risk. Some people don't. Some people will say, well, do I have to take it? And I say, no, but if you don't, you don't leave the risk behind when you leave my exam room. You take it with you. And they sometimes look at you like, well, that's not fair. But, you know, I think once people understand, they have and especially after they see an abnormal calcium score, they do have much more interest in doing something about it.
So again, like it's always like dumbfounding for the patient to realize that there's something wrong with their body because they don't feel anything. But
right.
A lot of people, I guess, show up and say, hey, look, I've got a family history and I want to get checked out by a tip-top cardiologist. What do you usually do if someone says, yes, I'd like some intervention? How do you handle somebody with a positive calcium score that they came in and handed you the report and said, doctor, can you help?
Right. So I tell them there are many things that you can do. You can try to live a healthy lifestyle, which would include having a heart-healthy diet, avoiding saturated fats and excess carbohydrates, eating plenty of fruits and vegetables and nuts. And I tell them about the Mediterranean diet, which is a very good general diet. A study number of years ago showed the incidence of coronary heart disease events in individuals on the American diet. The typical American diet was about 10 times higher than that on a typical Mediterranean diet, which includes, you know, fruits, vegetables, extra virgin olive oil, fish, small amounts of meat, and some extra virgin olive oil. I try to say things that they're going to remember. Like I tell them about the gut microbiome, the population of 10 trillion microorganisms that are in your gut, and the fact that 10% of the chemicals or metabolites that your body makes are actually made by these bacteria, and that what you eat influences which types of organisms grow. So, for instance, if an individual eats a lot of beef, it tends to foster development of microorganisms in the gut, which release inflammatory metabolites. And so, you know, I use the old expression, you are what you eat, is certainly very apt here. I then talk about an exercise program if they are if I feel that it's safe to do so. Some people will require, you know, other testing, including stress testing, before you give them the okay to undergo an exercise program. And then I talk to them about the various drugs that are available to try to decrease risk, including lipid-lowering drugs and this new drug that has been developed, that has been patented, called Lodoco, which is a low-dose form of colchicine, which was approved last year by the FDA to reduce vascular inflammation and reduce coronary heart disease, death, heart attack, stroke, and need for coronary revascularization procedures such as stents or bypass grafts. In the studies that were done, they showed that if you had either established atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease or multiple risk factors for it, it could reduce those factors by 31%.
So that sounds fantastic. Colchicine's been around for a long time, and hopefully that will be a way of the future. But, of course, it's early in that development of that drug, and that's fantastic. So how does a patient know if they're developing coronary artery disease? In other words, we talked about the calcium score where somebody's family doctor wanted to make sure. Mm-hmm. What tips somebody off that, hey, look, I got to go see Phil Nemoyten?
Well, other than that, if they're having any symptoms, or as I said, if they just wanted to get checked because of somebody else they know who has the problem that didn't know about it, because what's very interesting is that an artery can become narrowed up to a reduction in diameter of about 75%, after which additional small decreases in diameter create much greater changes in flow. And so very often, the onset of symptoms is a late finding. And what's also been found is that an artery that has a plaque that is not flow limiting, say a 40% narrowing, is more likely to result in a heart attack than one that is. The classic example was Tim Russert, the newscaster, who 2 weeks before a documented fatal heart attack had a normal stress test. And the reason for that is that the plaque that is not flow limiting often has a lot more lipid and a thinner cap than the plaque which is narrowing an artery, say 95% narrowed, where you have a smaller amount of lipid in there and a very, very thick cap over the plaque. The thin cap on the 40% narrowing is more subject to disruption. There's three different types of disruption, the two most common being either rupture of the cap or erosion of the cap. And then the plaque opens, the materials inside, including the inflammatory cells, inflammatory chemicals, and clot-promoting chemicals get exposed to the blood, a clot forms, and a heart attack occurs. So over 60% of people who have a heart attack have it based on disruption of a plaque that prior to the event was not flow limiting, would not have produced symptoms, and not shown up on a stress test. So to wait for symptoms, you could be at risk for having a serious or even fatal heart attack before the onset of symptoms. And that's the challenge. That's the challenge here.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to predict what's coming around the corner, I think, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
And what you're saying is those plaques, if you actually take your fingers at autopsy and push in, you can see all this gruel just come out. And you can see really, you know, how things are going to evolve into that plaque and that obstruction and possibly the death of the patient.
Right.
So do you ever describe that to a patient, and do they ever respond to that? So, hey, look, we can't tell, but this is usually what can happen. And say your family had a history. Does that at all work with the patient who's teetering on, I want to get treated or I don't want to get treated?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because what I find throughout the discussion is that the one where you see their eyes open up and they like get taken aback is when you tell them that the plaque that they may not know about, that may be 20, 30, 40% narrowed, is more likely to kill them than the one that is causing symptoms, because most of these people coming in don't have symptoms, and this really alerts them to the fact that they could be at risk for a major problem. And that's why I think the the additional testing that is being done is changing somewhat. You know, very often people would come in and say, my buddy just had a heart attack, I want a stress test. And so you have to explain to these people that a stress test will only pick up a narrowing of 75% or greater in one of the arteries. So if you're physically active and you have no symptoms and you're not diabetic, which would obscure symptoms, the likelihood is that that person's stress test will be normal. And yet he could be walking around with a potentially life-threatening plaque. And so in the past few years, the usefulness of this test called CT, coronary angiography, where you do a CAT scan with injection of X-ray dye in a vein of the arm, will give you very, very good pictures of the arteries. So you can see plaque that isn't narrowing the arteries. And now there's been the addition of two other methods that can be added to the coronary CT angiography. One is to use an artificial intelligence system to actually be able to characterize the nature of the plaque and how vulnerable it may be to disruption. And there's another one where they can actually look at the flow through the artery to see if a narrowing in the artery is limiting flow. But the only time that you wouldn't want to do the coronary CT angiogram is if the person has already been determined to have a very high calcium score, because then the calcium, like if somebody has a calcium score of 1,000, the calcium will cause a scatter of the X-rays called a blooming effect, and then the CT angiogram may not be able to be diagnostic in terms of telling you how significant a narrowing is.
Well, Phil, I'm so happy that you're here, because I didn't know about that. So it's good to listen to Inside Medicine with pros like yourself. So how often does insurance companies pay for this ability to discern whether or not that plaque is sufficient at this time and the patient is at high risk for a puncture of the plaque and acute coronary event?
Your question is very, very appropriate, because this is changing as the guidelines have changed. Many of the insurance companies are now approving a CT coronary angiogram as an alternative to a nuclear stress test, and in some cases they're even preferring it. And it actually, in many cases,
so they want to know too, so that they save money.
Right, because it's much cheaper. You got it, much cheaper. And it also has usually significantly less radiation when done with one of the newer machines.
I just want to come back and say, I appreciate the insurance guys, you know, moving forward with technology, because obviously they would save more money and will save more patients. So I love it. So when someone comes in and says, look, my father died of an MI, my brother just had a stress test, and they say, doctor, how can I prevent any coronary artery disease in myself? How do you respond to that question?
Well, I tell them we need to do the evaluation that they came there for, which includes the history of exactly what happened in the family, examining them, looking at their electrocardiogram, looking at all their lipid tests, usually the calcium scoring test, and then coming up with an individual plan of what to do. That plan almost, always includes the guidance on, proper diet, avoidance of smoking, controlling weight, checking other things like the blood sugar and so forth. And then when appropriate, advising you know, an exercise plan and then appropriate drug therapy.
Gotcha. So how often does the patient's mouth open up when you say, look, I want to give you a nitroglycerin to take home. I want to get you on a statin. We have to improve your blood pressure. I didn't like the flow in your toes and your dorsalis pedis vein. I mean, how does a patient respond to that? Because that's a lot to put on somebody, but you hate to have somebody walk out your door without a full game plan to make sure that they keep on coming back.
I see the full spectrum of people coming in saying, you know, I know I'm worried about this and I want to do something about it. On the other hand, I all the way on the other extreme is the person who comes in and says, I've been told that I need a statin and I'm coming here because I don't think I do. And I want you to tell me the same thing. Just yesterday, I saw a gentleman who, very educated guy who had been told by two physicians he needed to be on a statin. He decided he didn't want to do that because of what he had read about perceived side effects. And so he came in to see me and yesterday came back on his return visit after his calcium score was done. And his calcium score showed that it was very high. And after you do the percentile calculation, there's also a calculation you can do based on an old study that was done many years ago where you estimate what the future risk of a coronary event is relative to a similarly matched group of people who have no calcium, and his was 10. So I explained to him, your risk of a future coronary event is 10 times somebody just like you who has zero calcium. And he said, okay, send the prescription in. You know, so I think, as you had indicated earlier, that calcium scoring test really does make a difference in the patient's interest in doing something proactively.
Good. So what are some of the so I assume hypertension is something that cardiologists look for.
Right.
I don't want to act too dumb, but is there a do you guys have a certain RX that you prefer to use in somebody who comes in, looks like they may have coronary artery disease and their blood pressure is, say, a diastolic of 115? And how do you intervene in those patients?
If they need things like weight reduction, sodium restriction, and so forth, I'll advise that. But as far as drug therapy, my preference for initial antihypertensive therapy in somebody who doesn't have any specific reason why they would have to avoid or why they would have to take a certain class of antihypertensives, I'll usually start with a once-a-day angiotensin receptor blocker, such as Valsartan or Losartan, because they're once a day and they have very, very little side effects. Many people will have almost no side effects. But you have to counsel the patients when they are very hypertensive that don't just assume that if you don't feel so great right after you start taking the drug that it's an actual side effect of the drug, because somebody whose blood pressure has been very elevated will feel somewhat different as their blood pressure is being lowered. That's just the result of the blood pressure being lowered, and that will usually abate with time.
Okay, so basically you start with a long-acting drug, which makes it easier for the patient to comply.
Right.
And what about nitroglycerin? Does everybody get a nitroglycerin bottle when they leave and just tell them, hey, look, don't put any cotton in the bottle and just make sure that you have it available just in case. How do people respond to nitroglycerin?
Yeah, I generally don't do that unless I'm concerned that the patient, really needs it, but not just to give it to everybody who comes in.
Okay. And do you want to, how do you project the need for a LDL reduction, via a statin drug, because there's so many people come in and are a bit resistant to that or a lot resistant to that in my practice.
Right. So many people are. And what I explain to them is that based upon their particular situation, based upon their lipids, with or without the calcium score, that they do need the statin drug. I explain to them that there are two sources of cholesterol in your body, the main source being what you produce, and that's blocked by the statins, and the smaller percentage, which is what you ingest, and the absorption of that in the small bowel is blocked by a drug called ezetimibe. So very often we'll use a combination of a statin and ezetimibe. And I explained to them that the statins also have an additional effect in that they stabilize plaque that's in the artery and make that plaque less likely to disrupt and cause a heart attack. In fact, Paul Ridker, who is the cardiologist from Brigham and Women's up in Boston, who is the pioneer in the concept of vascular inflammation, he showed in a study done in 2008 called the Jupiter Study that he took a group of individuals who actually had normal lipids, but they had an elevation of their high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, and he put them on 20 milligrams of rosuvastatin, which is the generic form of Crestor, and showed a significant reduction in risk. And that that really was the first major trial that showed real evidence that reducing vascular inflammation decreased risk. So the statins are the cornerstone of lipid-lowering therapy, and then adding in ezetimibe when appropriate, because that can also give you a bigger drop sometimes than doubling the statin, and you can then minimize the statin side effects. Beyond those two drugs, there are two injectable drugs called PCSK9 inhibitors. One of them is Repatha. The other one is Praluent. These are drugs that can be given every 2 weeks by a little pen injector. It looks like a disposable pen light. Very easy to use, almost no side effects, and those drugs can lower the LDL cholesterol by 60%. They can reduce cardiac events by about 15% in appropriate patients, and they can also cause some regression of soft plaque, not calcified plaque, but soft plaque in some individuals. And then there's one other drug called Leqvio, which is an infusion that's given twice a year at an infusion center after an initial two doses 3 months apart, and that can lower LDL cholesterol by about 50%.
Is that last one, is that inclisiran, the generic name?
Yes, yes.
Okay, got it. All right, so it seems to me like, you know, pharmacology has advanced a lot, because that drug like inclisiran is phenomenal. Do we have, you talked about LPA in the past. Is there any special drug that you go after for LPA, lipoprotein small a, because I don't think the statins work against that.
No, they don't. They don't. There's no approved drug for LP little a as of now, although the two PCSK9 inhibitors, the Repatha and the Praluent, do lower LP little a by about 22%. They have not been approved for that indication. But the data presumably is coming in showing that the mechanism is effective in reducing risk. The first drug will probably be available late 2025. It's a drug called pelacarsen. It's a drug developed by a small pharmaceutical company, but will be marketed by one of the major pharmaceutical houses. And it's estimated to lower LP little a by 70 to 80% at maximum dose. The other concern is that because the LP little a is such a strong risk factor and has strong inflammatory and pro-clotting effects, many experts are advising their patients who have an elevated LP little a to be on low-dose aspirin, even though the American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association guidelines, as of a number of years ago, removed the recommendation for using aspirin to prevent first heart attack. So that would be in people without a diagnosis of coronary artery disease. Currently, the guidelines are only recommending the use of that in either people with established coronary artery disease, or if they're deemed to be at high risk by their cardiologist, then this would be considered one of the reasons that people may be at high risk.
So let me just ask you this. That drives me crazy what you just said, because, I mean, we know that a baby aspirin, if you get a high-quality one that's coated, is not going to result in GI bleeds like regular aspirin. So it doesn't make sense to me. So just not to put you on the spot, but to put you on the spot, if your patients have a high LPA, do they usually walk out of your office with a enteric aspirin 81?
If they have an elevated...
No.
Yes, if they have an elevated LPA, they do. The guidelines, that recommendation changed when there was some data from the UK showing that older people, especially over 70 and especially even more over 80, had an increased risk of gastrointestinal bleeding. So they said only use it for secondary prevention, meaning in people with a diagnosis of coronary artery disease, unless they're deemed to be at high risk under age 70 and have no increased risk of bleeding. But some of these people over 70, you know, are getting it if they do have an elevated LPA.
Well, that's fantastic. The only thing is, I don't think most of the cardiology group has picked up LPA on everybody. Am I wrong on that? You can say yes for sure.
You are right. In fact,
are we screening for LPA?
I screen it on all my new patients, and it's, you only have to screen it once because it stays pretty stable. It's not influenced by most other things except for those two drugs. It was very, very interesting. I was down at the American College of Cardiology annual meeting in Atlanta in March, and there was a big exhibit from the company that is going to be marketing the first drug. And so they were offering free free testing for LP little A, and there was a whole line of cardiologists there getting tested. I couldn't imagine why they didn't already know whether they had elevated LPA. But you're right, it's not being commonly tested, but I think it's being a lot more tested now as people, as cardiologists know that there will be a drug. And so I think they're trying to identify all their people who may be a candidate for it.
Moving forward, I love that. So let me just ask another question. What's the best diet to prevent coronary artery disease? I'm sure you get that question from 99% of your patients, and they hope that they can eat everything they want. Am I wrong?
You're right. I mean, I think for most people that don't want to get into a lot of detail, to recommend the Mediterranean diet is an easy thing for them to go look up and try to comply with. But some people want more, more specific information. I also try to counsel my patients that to eat more natural, unprocessed foods as opposed to just saying all natural. You know, I see these increasing numbers of products in some of the stores, expensive packaged goods that say all natural, and then you look at the bottom and you need a microscope to see the 100 different ingredients that are in there. And I try to explain to them that the more unprocessed it is, the better, because many all-natural foods may not be that natural. There was just a study recently came out of the Cleveland Clinic where a number of years ago they identified that erythritol, the artificial sweetener that's in so many things and classified as generally regarded as safe by the FDA, increased risk of heart attack and stroke, doubled the risk of heart attack and stroke, and now they publish a subsequent paper showing the mechanism that it actually caused clumping of the platelets, the clotting cells in the blood. So it is not just an association, but it's a real risk. And just as an example, I don't want to get on your turf of endocrinology, but I'll say to a patient, for instance, if you drink a glass of orange juice, you've got a single component sugar that gets immediately absorbed. You get an insulin surge, your blood sugar drops, you get hungry, and you go through this horrible cycle. Whereas if you would eat the orange instead and the sugar is tied up in fiber and so forth, you'll get less of a sudden response, and you'll be better off eating the orange than the glass of orange juice. I don't know if you feel that's a significant factor or not. You're the expert.
Hey, the answer is that if we can make our patients live longer and better, I'm for it. And from now on, it's going to be get that orange and cut it up and forget any juice.
Right.
I'm anti-juice anyway because it kicks the sugar up too much and it just drives me crazy. They have to have their orange juice in the morning.
Right.
So can exercise prevent coronary artery disease? Should everybody be running around my neighborhood like they did when it was COVID and everybody was hanging out at home and they all did walking at night? Can exercise prevent coronary artery disease?
I don't know if it can prevent it, but in people who have been deemed by their physician to be safe to exercise, I think it can help with a lot of things, including blood pressure control, blood sugar control, lipid control. It's been shown that if you're physically active over the years and you have any what they call collateral vessels, where the coronary arteries, which are usually three vessels that end each separately. Some people have little connections between one and the other, and if you are developing a narrowing in one of the arteries and you have these connections over time, exercise may help the little connections to develop better. But I don't want anybody to think I'm recommending exercise without going to your cardiologist or primary care physician and getting the clearance to do that, as well as what they call an exercise prescription, where you basically get told what you should be doing, what the limits should be, and how you should monitor that.
So Phil, can you just explain what is a collateral vessel? Because I think it's very important, and I don't hear any people talking about it, but you live cardiology. So what is a collateral vessel?
So the three arteries that supply the heart muscle with blood are usually arteries which are they end separately. So that you have an artery on the left called the left main that divides into two arteries. One's called the left anterior descending, and one's called the circumflex. And then you have a separate artery on the right. But those three arteries don't connect further down with each other. But some people have very small connections. Called collateral vessels. And so if you have an artery that is getting narrowed slowly over time and there's decreased flow going down, but that person is lucky enough to have a connection between that artery beyond the blockage and another artery, the flow from the other artery coming through the collateral may be more than the flow going down the initial artery, and those collaterals may develop over time. And so you can actually, it's almost like getting a natural bypass. So you can see somebody who comes in and, you could see they have evidence on their nuclear stress test that they have a decrease in blood flow, say, to the heart muscle and the distribution of the right coronary artery. And then you get a catheterization and you see that the right coronary artery may be totally blocked, but there's excellent flow going backward up into the right coronary artery. And so there may not be enough to allow the person to be fully active without symptoms, but that person may in the end avoid a heart attack because although that artery has totally blocked, they didn't develop damage because there was this backward flow through the collaterals.
I think that's fantastic. God's a slick engineer. That's all I can say.
Right.
Can you just move forward to what is vascular inflammation? That's kind of two big words, vascular inflammation.
Yeah, so vascular inflammation is when you get the lining of the artery gets affected in the same way that you might see inflammation somewhere else in the body, where you get elsewhere in the body, you may see redness, you may see heat, you may see things like that. As the artery develops plaque, and then the plaque becomes more active, you get release of these inflammatory chemicals from the white blood cells in the plaque after it ingests the lipid material. So the lipids get ingested by white blood cells called monocytes. As they ingest the lipid, they get transformed into other types of white blood cells called macrophages. They start to release these inflammatory chemicals. And so what was found after Dr. Ridker did this study called the Jupiter trial, where he showed the benefit of statins, he did a landmark trial in 2017 called the CANTOS trial, where he used an investigational agent that blocked an inflammatory pathway that produced chemicals which eventually get into the liver and get transformed into this cardio-C-reactive protein chemical that he was measuring. And he showed that there was a significant – these were people who had a heart attack, and they had their lipids controlled, but their cardio-C-reactive protein was elevated. He gave them this agent, and he showed a significant decrease in risk. That product was not feasible to market because of cost and side effects. And so there was a search on for what other drug – might block this very specific pathway. So this is not, he's not looking for an anti-inflammatory like ibuprofen or something, because that's a totally different pathway. In fact, ibuprofen can be hazardous in people with coronary artery disease. And so it turns out that three other conditions have been treated by colchicine. One is gout, one is familial Mediterranean fever, and the third one is pericarditis. And in fact, in studies where they looked, they started to look at this, they saw that in studies where people had been on colchicine long-term for gout, they actually had decreased cardiovascular events. And when they saw that this was the same pathway that involves these chemicals called interleukin 1 and interleukin 6 and so forth, these are what they call inflammatory mediators, they saw that colchicine blocked that pathway, the same pathway that was blocked by this other agent in the CANTOS trial. And so there were three studies done where they used low-dose colchicine, and they specifically did not use the same dose of colchicine that was used for gout, which is a 0.6 milligram. This was a 0.5 milligram because this particular drug is very safe at 0.5, but if you use it long-term at the gout dose, it can produce problems, especially if you have any impairment of kidney function. The gout patients and the pericarditis patients were only taking it for short term, and so it was safe in that situation. But this newly patented form, this Lodoco, was produced at the lower dose of 0.5 milligrams, which was found to be very safe unless the person had significant kidney dysfunction or liver dysfunction. And they showed this significant reduction in cardiovascular risk, and that's why the FDA approved the marketing of this drug for reduction of risk in individuals with either established atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease or multiple risk factors for that. So what many cardiologists are doing is treating the lipids, and then once you get the lipids down to the target levels for that individual, if you still see elevation of the cardio-C-reactive protein, then using the Lodoco to reduce what's been termed by Dr. Ridker residual inflammatory risk. Now, the drug was approved on the basis of studies that did not specifically look at cardio-CRP, so it can be used for anybody with either coronary artery disease or multiple risk factors. But if you see that this cardio-CRP is high after you've treated the lipids, that's even more of a reason to consider the use of this drug. And consequently, in the U.S. And the Canadian guidelines, they list it as an option to use. And in the European Society for Cardiology, which meets annually over Labor Day weekend, they just changed it from a 2B recommendation to a 2A recommendation, which means they were previously saying can be considered in these individuals, and they're now saying should be considered in these individuals. So it's gotten, you know, guideline support.
And that's Lodoco 0.5. You got to make sure you don't use the standard gout 0.6. Is that correct?
Right. Some of the insurance companies will send back a prior authorization request saying, you haven't tried the generic. The generic is the wrong dose. It hasn't been approved by the FDA, and it's not an equivalent product. So it's got to be the Lodoco. It's spelled L-O-D-O-C-O, like low-dose colchicine is the way to
Fantastic.
Remember it.
Fantastic. A patient should never try and increase that dose and say, hey, one's good, I'm going to get two because I want to make sure I stick around. That's bad thinking.
Absolutely not. No, more of a good thing is not necessarily better. You're absolutely right.
Okay. So is Lodoco then taking some edge off of that vascular inflammation that we were talking about earlier?
Yes, and what you can see in patients who do have an elevation of the cardio-CRP, you do see that level does go down with the Lodoco.
Fantastic. So Phil, can you just give me a little bit of a summary here? Because we end up at 10:55:30. I could keep you longer, but the radio station says time to get off, Joe. So how would you summarize what an individual can do to make sure they decrease their risk of death and improve their well-being?
I would say either see your primary care physician or your cardiologist, get a comprehensive history, physical exam, an electrocardiogram, comprehensive lipid studies, including the LPA, the hsCRP, and the ApoB, and a calcium score, and then sit down for a thorough discussion of what your risk is and what ought to be done in terms of diet, exercise, and or drug therapy to try to minimize risk.
So we have a lot of patients that are hanging out to see good cardiologists. So I hope they listen to our show and hear how astute you are. How do you get in touch with Phil Nemoyten? And are you already booked up with patients?
I've never wanted to take that attitude that I'm booked up, because I think that's sort of a mindset. I am available. I'm at Cardiology Consultants of Philadelphia. We're right across the street from the main Jefferson Hospital on 10th and Chestnut Streets. Our phone number is 267-479-4180.
That's Dr. Phil Nemoyten, MD, FACC. Phil, can you just give your phone number out again, please?
Sure, 267-479-4180.
Phil Nemoyten, Dr. Phil Nemoyten, thank you for being on. We couldn't get a better guest, and we will be back next week. Listen to Inside Medicine. Remember, his podcast will be up in about 30 minutes. Thank you, Joe.
Thank
Fallon,
you, Joe. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Phil.